Hey there, welcome to Broadcast to Post. I'm Jeff Sengpiel, CTO at Keycode Media. This is the show where we interview leaders and experts in the AV, broadcast, and post-production spaces. We're giving you the inside tips to grow your media workflows and business today. Thanks everybody for coming on down the hall. We're going to be talking about the state of government video. We're going to go through introductions. Jeff, why don't you kick it off?
Hi, my name is Jeff Pilvent. We're from Columbus, Ohio. We work for the Ohio Channel, which is basically, easiest way I can describe it is C-SPAN for Ohio. I have been there for 18, 19 years now, and I'm the engineering operations manager.
Connor? I'm Connor Gilmore. I've been working at the Ohio Channel now for just shy of two and a half years, and I'm the technical operations specialist, pretty much just a broadcast engineer, IT for broadcast.
Yep.
And I'm Jeff Sengpiel. I'm the CTO for Keycode Media. Out here to visit everybody and have a great show and talk with these folks about what they do best. So, Jeff, we'll start with you. Tell us a little bit about your department, how things work within the state, and how you approach your content and broadcast strategy.
Yeah, okay. I'll give you a little background first. So like I said, we're the Ohio Channel, also pseudo-state agency side of it is Ohio Government Telecommunications. We provide basically streaming, video, broadcast services, recording, documentation for all legislative committees, state legislative sessions, Supreme Court sessions, do governor's press conferences. During COVID, we did a lot with like all our governor's COVID press conferences. We did all of those over the air, over streaming, all those other things like that. We were actually started as an agency back in 1996 when they renovated our actual offices, and our broadcast facilities are in the basement of the Ohio State House. So when they renovated the building historically to bring it up to, to re-renovate it and everything like that back in 1996, they contracted and actually brought in and built TV studios and wired up the building with triacs and audio video and all that other stuff throughout the building to make the product more accessible. For the first several years, they only did, I've been there since about 2004. So when they first started, they were only strictly doing the legislative chamber sessions where they had, Sony tracks, cameras, and stuff like that set up. We've kind of gradually, we do a lot of other, back then we didn't have as much to do, so we do some, let me go back a step. We're also affiliated, we got a distribution, we're affiliated with all the PBS stations in Ohio too. We're plugged into that system. So we are kind of an offshoot of that. We are actually managed by the Cleveland PBS station, IdeaStream in Cleveland. The state grants the money to them and they manage us, but we do provide direct services to the legislative branch. Sorry, long story short. But anyways, so back in probably about 2015, we were then allocated to start expanding our coverage. So we then started having to do more. We brought online a couple committee rooms, wired up committee rooms with cameras like that. And by 2019, we got the go-ahead to basically wire up every room in the building. Previously, probably around 2016, we kind of knew this was on the horizon. So we ran fiber through most of the building to necessitate HD signals because we knew we were heading in that direction. We actually flipped over to HD in 2017. And so in 2019, we basically expanded from about three or four committee rooms to a total of 15, I believe, if I remember right, and a press conference room too. So we can get into that in the next question, but that required a massive build out and a massive infrastructure and anything else like that. So that's kind of, again, easiest way to describe what we do is we're C-SPAN for Ohio. We provide all our content airs on a subcarrier, a .2 on the PBS station channels over the air. And then we also stream and archive everything on our website, which is managed by a state IT agency. So,
which actually gives you a very huge reach.
Yes, yeah. We do have it, whether or not people are watching it, but we learned during the pandemic that our reach is definitely a lot further than we thought it was originally. So it's actually been a good surprise.
Very cool. Is there a recent technical project you've worked on? What made it cool and unique?
Yeah, so basically around 2016, 2017, we started venturing down the road of digital asset management storage system. Taking all our tapes, bringing them over into the IT world, bringing them into IT. We started in then, and our initial system with another vendor was about a 350 terabyte active storage system. and we also had an LTO system as a backup. When we got the go-ahead to expand all our coverage into the committees, we, in 2019, we learned that was completely going to be inadequate because we were running out of space left and right. Our active storage was constantly getting full, getting backed up, and all that other, you know. So we started probably around right before the pandemic, we started doing a lot of research on what system we wanted to do to bring that up to what we need for the new workflow and the amount of coverage we were actually producing. In some ways, the pandemic in that way was a blessing because even though we were kind of doing a lot of press conferences, we weren't doing a lot of legislative sessions. We were doing a few here and there. But throughout the first part of the pandemic in early 2020, it gave us a lot of time to kind of take a step back and do a lot of research. We sat through multiple vendor calls, multiple manufacturer calls, all sorts of just between Connor, myself, and another employee we had on our staff. We were in meetings constantly just learning about what was going on and determining what size we needed and stuff like that. So finally we reached about spring of 2021, and we kind of narrowed down. We were looking for about a petabyte of active storage on our system to house all this stuff, data and all our other programming and stuff like that. So we then decided to pursue a petabyte of storage. We were going to move away from the LTO and move more toward an AWS cloud-based storage for our deep archive, but our main storage was going to be our main storage LTO was going to be the system. And we ended up, after all the research, going with SNS and Evo. We thought, cost-wise, we are a state agency given state funds, so we are very responsible with what we do and what we choose to do. We're always trying to choose the most cost-effective option for the citizens of our state so we don't run over budget and everything like that. And it provided the best solution for efficiency, for ease of use, and for value customer-wise and stuff like that. We were able to bump the system up too with us to... Our original system was 8 gig fiber channel. Just so we say, we did have fiber run throughout most of the building, so we could connect it from the server room down to our station and then out to the desktops via fiber. But we did switch over to 25 gig with this new thing, which has improved the speeds and improved the ease of use of getting stuff back and forth. So it's been a great project to work on. We definitely learned a lot about the systems and everything else moving forward. Connor, do you want to throw anything else in?
How did it make your life easier?
Yeah, so most of what I've been doing over the past couple of years has been handling a lot of changes to operational efficiency, infrastructure, all that kind of thing. So most of what I've done is working with SNS and KeyCode, making sure we were up and running for the storage system, and then pushing all of our deep archive to AWS. And maintaining that, as well as a couple of backups of our web files, because we did have sort of a, not crisis, but problem where we lost access to that for a short amount of time, and we had to rebuild that. So it's just rebuilding redundancy and trying to keep that gathering of resources as efficient as possible and as cost effective as possible.
Yeah, we do store, like I said, all of our files are archived. I mean, it's everything from 1996 on back. So we have a web file archive. We are obligated to work with a state agency to kind of curate this, the website, the files and stuff like that. And we did have back in January when we were getting ready to switch over, that we were kind of bit by the shipping and the delays and all the stuff falling out of the pandemic, where we ordered the equipment in September and we tried to keep our existing system running as long as we can, even though it was getting towards the end of a thing, but because of the end of its, you know, usefulness and getting full, but because of the shipping delays and stuff like that, we weren't able to actually get the system. It was mostly the switches, the 25 gig switches, we weren't able to get most of them until February. So we did run into an issue where we had a data crash on our system, but because of the redundancies we had built in, we were able to recover all of that with assistance and help, so we didn't lose it, because our web files are basically what most of the general public interacts with. We have, you know, full res video files stored on our Evo system now, and the deep archives are in AWS currently, and actually they're still stored. We still have the LTO running too, so we actually have several versions of redundant copies, but we have also learn that, you know, we're going to keep multiple now copies of the web files and this. So we actually just recently finished setting up another Synology server too, and we're pushing all the web files to that. So if we ever do have a website crash or a system crash of where they are linked, we will now also, we can easily just relink the website, because our website is, it's not run through an outside company, it's not YouTube, it is personally, it was developed by our web developer with the state help, and it is completely custom interface. So it's meant for storing the videos and easy access to the videos. We have a very robust metadata system built into it, where it's like, it's kind of like a YouTube thing where you can go to the file and click a timestamp, and then you bring up the bill. You bring up when the representative speaks. That's what they want. That's what they want to ask for. So when they want to tell their constituents that I voted on this bill, and you can go to this video and look at this timestamp, find my name in it, and click on it and watch me talk. I mean, they want that type of, not just for their own research, but to be able to keep their constituents informed of what they're doing and what's going on in the legislative process. So we do help facilitate that. So,
and it sounds like your redundancies are why you had a problem and not a crisis.
Yeah, we did have an active backup. It's just this was the first time, in 2017, we were new to the whole digital thing. I'm more of a broadcast engineer. Mm-hmm. I came from that kind of school, so I am become very quickly adept to the IT world and learn more about that now. So it is a new world. All of you and all that, it's like we're moving that direction. That's what we've been doing the last probably 10 years or so. So this was our first major thing, but our data redundancy worked. It just took a lot longer to recover the data than we thought. It was our first real experience with recovering data, but it all came back. We all got it, didn't lose anything, and now we're building it's a learning experience. We now have a more robust data, system moving forward, so we have another, place to get it back quicker. I mean, when we finish getting this online, and it's pretty much online now, actually, as of this like a week or so ago, it'll just be like if something goes down with the main server where our web files are stored like that, it's just a call them, point and click, point it at the new server, everything's back up and running. So redundancy is definitely the name of the game, whether it's, deep store archive or anything like that. For stuff that we do in government, it's definitely needing to have multiple copies in multiple places available quickly to be restored. So,
yep, the data backup model, 3-2-1.
Yep.
Three copies, two separate mediums, and one offsite.
Yep.
And that's the AWS part
yep.
of it there. So what have been... what's been your process for, we know how when you had the time to do the research, how things went. What's the normal process for that happens for you folks when you're going to go upgrade technology? What concerns have you had about this process in figuring out what is new and how do you figure out what's possible?
So I think for us, the process, it being, depending on the scale of the project, a lot of that goes to, a bidding system for equipment, and that's not just a cost-benefit analysis. I mean, it is, but it's not just associated with cost. It's so, for example, if we're going for 25 gig over 10 gig, something along those lines, more storage that will be more effective and longer lasting through support, all that kind of stuff. And when you're working with that many vendors, it's at least three in our process, I think.
At least three for,
is you can kind of get lost in the information. So seeing all of it laid out over time, being able to research it, really read over it, correct anything that you see is extremely helpful. So having, because I came in right essentially a month before COVID hit officially, and that was a massive learning experience because it was a lot of information thrown quickly and it's very easy to get overwhelmed with that. So all of that of making sure you have the ample time, even under a time crunch, to make sure you're getting everything right the first time.
Yeah, and the only other thing I would add to that is, like he was saying, it's all about what is the best value going for. We always are stressed, wanting to make sure that we get the best value for the people we serve, the legislator and the taxpayers who are ultimately giving us the funds to do this. We always, like he was saying, the 25 gig versus 10 gig analysis, we don't get funds allocated. I mean, we could get a lot of money 1 year and then not get anything for 10 years, depending on how revenues go and stuff like that. So when we make a decision, we have to again, look at what is going to be the best value and also allow for the most forward-looking, because a lot of the times it's not going to be like, oh, something else comes out better, we can just replace it. No, we're going to have to make this, you know, we're not Hollywood. We're going to have to make this piece of equipment and stuff last for 5 plus 10 years, you know, looking forward into the future. Because we don't know, you never know with what your resources are going to be coming in. We have a rough idea and a rough budget, but we're subject to the whims of, you know, economics like anybody else. So,
exactly. Well, and the thing is, there's value and then there's cost. So sometimes the best value isn't necessarily the lowest cost. And that's something to keep in mind. Because if you buy something that's really cheap, but you have to replace it every year mm-hmm. at the same price, that's not necessarily the best value. Main challenges today. What have you been doing to overcome these things?
Well, I mean, obviously, everybody, COVID was a major challenge. You go from planning for one thing, and then the next day, everyone's at home, and we're trying to, you know, figure out how we're going to keep going. We in our state, we were relied upon to provide through our PBS distribution network as well as our streaming network. When the governor was giving daily press conferences updating the state on COVID, first couple times we were crashing our web servers. We were going through state equipment web servers, and they were set for like probably maybe if we were on a good day, 9,000-10,000 views or something like that. And all of a sudden, we were getting in the 100,000, you know, anywhere from 60,000 to 100,000, you know, views, because no one was doing it. Everything was turning into these things to figure out the information as it unfolded. We ended up working with our IT provider with the state, and they ended up getting us an AWS streaming server temporarily, which greatly improved the redundancy of being able to distribute to hundreds of thousands of people to get the message out. When it was needed. So, I mean, we were able to upgrade our system there, but then just the challenge of all our meetings at the time were all in person. We had two operators sitting there, one doing robotic cameras, one doing, you know, TDing and doing CGs and putting information up and audio and all that other stuff. And all of a sudden, you know, they're coming to us and they're like, well, we can't meet in person, but we want to meet virtually. So we're setting up systems that we can access both remotely through, you know, remote interfaces on machines and stuff like that. And also we're now trying to figure out how to integrate Zoom, like I'm sure a lot of you are too, into a broadcast level production. I mean, everyone's seen it where an event, you know, 5-6 years ago where you would have required on a satellite, now everyone's using Zoom or other products like that to get it. I mean, ESPN or any of the broadcast networks and stuff like that, it's just become commonplace. And, you know, at that time, you know, we were all trying to, like everyone else is trying to figure out, how do we get this in? How do we get it to look the best quality? How do we, you know, do it? And it was some trial and error. We, you know, have committees where you have the gallery screen and there's 30 people on there and you're like, what's that person doing? And what's it, you know, and you just trial and error. I mean, it's a lot of trial and error to get this going. So that was a big challenge, but we made it through. We were able to do, and then as they did come back, we then integrating both that Zoom call, which is so, you know, just second nature today, into an in-person meeting. So doing a hybrid meeting with a Zoom or a Microsoft Teams or something like that. We had those challenges too, which we overcame pretty well. And like, you know, we've had it where, you know, people are, you know, they'll call us now and they're like, hey, we need this one rep can't show up or this one member of this committee can't show up. We want to do a virtual, so you'll pull in a thing, TV, and set up a Zoom, and we'll take a feed out downstairs and log in and put it on the broadcast. I mean, it's just a lot of trial and error. In some ways, it was a lot of fun to learn all this stuff. I mean, it was a lot of learning and a lot of trial and error, like I said, and figuring it out, but I think we're totally in a better place for it now.
Yeah, and just a more recent example would be something like what we did with redistricting, which I wasn't as involved with, but involved more map makers being involved via Zoom from an entirely different room, sharing computers throughout that, making sure everyone can see it, making sure our stream can see it, bringing down multiple computers all at the same time, 24/7 streams of all of that, recordings, backups of everything associated with that. And a lot of it was overwhelming at first, but once we had the routine going, automations, everything that we normally do in our workflow, and those increased efficiency, the increased efficiency that we've had through remote accessing and the trial and error of GovPress conferences, hybrid meetings, was all extremely helpful in getting that set up and ready to go.
And I think it tells us too, and I'll brag a little bit here on Connor and our other former engineer Seth, is there was nothing when the three, we enjoy doing this. I mean, we enjoy troubleshooting. That's why we're doing this. We enjoy trying to figure things out, getting thrown a challenge that in the moment you're stressed out, but once you get it figured out, you know what you're doing. And I will brag on between our engineering team, which is me, Connor, and with Seth at the time, and our production staff. I mean, they were throwing things at us left and right, and we were always able to come up with some kind of solution. It may not have been, and that's one of the things I took out of the whole pandemic process too, is, I come from more of a traditional broadcast engineering background, and I remember working with people, and they'd be like, oh, that's not the way you do it, that's not the way you do it. Well, nowadays, it's not the way you do it doesn't cut it. You need to find a way to do it, and you need to be creative about how you find a way to do it. So
adapt and overcome. That's the whole point. Do you see hybrid meetings continuing into the future, even after post-COVID?
Yeah, I mean, we're still doing Zoom press conferences. Occasionally, our controlling board will meet.
Virtual.
Hybrid. A lot of it's still happening, and I don't think it's going away just for the ease of use that comes with that on the user end. And ultimately for us, once we got in the flow of things, had a routine set up, it actually became a little easier for us to manage rather than an in-person press conference where you need a camera operator or you need someone to run robotic cameras, you need a director, you're running a lot more things at once instead of just managing a Zoom call, dealing with who's on screen, and then that's kind of it.
Yeah, I mean, I think like anybody, not just in the broadcaster industry, but in every industry now, people have just gotten used to it. It's not going to go away. Yeah, there are people who prefer to meet in person, and there are going to be people who prefer to stay with the Zoom and work from home environments and things like that, but it's not going to go away. And I think there is a lot of value to it too, because at least in our field where you have representatives or politicians serving their constituents, it gives constituents who otherwise may not have been able to come and give their view on a piece of legislation or a topic or something like that, when you can invite that hybrid environment in, and they don't do it all the time, and it kind of depends on the person running it and stuff like that, but that option is available now, and it does give greater access to the process for the citizens.
So. You democratize the process of democracy.
Well, let's hope so.
So, where do you see things being in the future? This is always a weird question to ask, because you asked people that 4 years ago, hey, where do you see yourself in 4 years? You would never have said this. So where do you see things being, let's call it 3 to 5 years out from now?
I definitely see us continuing to modernize our equipment in the building and stuff like that. I definitely see the virtual environment continuing, if not expanding. We're continually moving towards, easiest way to put it, leaner and meaner and, less equipment. Like I said, cost is always a thing for us. We're always trying to provide the best value that we can so we don't, so I think it's going to be constantly researching, constantly looking to new technologies. Again, I think the COVID environment proved we can do it. I think a lot of the I think a lot of the hesitancy to try new things that we may not have done 5 years prior to this, before COVID, I think a lot of that's gone. I think everyone is willing, you want to do a Zoom call, you want to do this, well, it's like, all right, let's just find a way to make it work. I mean, because we've done it, and, everyone's figured it out. Not everyone's figured it out, but, if we don't know how to do it, we're going to figure out how to do it, because that's what's needed to make our environment work.
Yeah, I mean, that pretty much sums up what I'd feel, because modernizing our equipment, we're still on a lot of analog audio, but everything shifted to Cat 5, Cat 6, and it's about bringing in new equipment that can cut down on, one, the potential mistakes we could make, say with routing or whatever it is, missing little things like that. There's always ways to check what's going wrong, how to fix it as efficiently as possible, and just making our workflow more tolerable in the sense of there's less to keep track of in your head. It's all easily managed from like one device instead of 10 to do the same thing. It's all about modernization. That's just going to continue like it always has, I think.
Technology, it's always changing. That's the only constant. Any questions from our audience? Because I've run out of things on my iPad.
Are you talking like a hybrid type environment?
Yeah.
We came up with a way that basically we kind of added what we call our virtual control room. We have a Blackmagic ATEM switcher, and we have a Taranix that we use to take the computer in. We will operate basically as a viewer on the call, and then we will route that into our production switcher, which has our four cameras, and then it'll just show up as a source down there, and we will pin the talker, the viewer, or something like that. So whoever's talking on that call will pop up. I then also, took the router or took the audio out through, a breakout and ran it in through a board. So we still have the person that, let's say it's a committee. You have a person direct. We have general in our committee rooms. We have four cameras to cover a wide swath of the room. So we'll have the four cameras there for them to cover the people in the room. We have the audio source coming down from in the room on one fader on the board in the production room. We will then have the window up in the corner of the Zoom call coming out of the Taranix into the switcher. We didn't do audio follow video because we were finding some issues with sync and stuff like that. So we will run it through a frame sync and bring it into the board onto another fader. So it is the responsibility of the director of the committee for the hybrid ones to kind of balance between the two to eliminate any feedback in the room, because a lot of the times what we do have on the other end is the other person that's logged into a Zoom call on a TV up in the room or a display up in the room, and they're just listening to the audio through the TV to keep it in lip sync, so we don't run into any feedback issues with the sound system in the room and stuff like that. But the flexibility of some of the Blackmagic stuff that we found is, again, cost-effective, and we've been able to integrate the computers. We always try and we try not to be like in the, all the other reps will call into the meeting, they'll be their own things. Usually someone from a communication staff or something like that will manage the meeting. We will just then log in as our Ohio Channel account and kind of basically just be a fly on the wall. We're nonpartisan. Our agency is nonpartisan. We don't work for one side or the other. We serve everybody, no matter what their affiliation is. So we try to always maintain as neutral as we can. When a call like that, we don't want to be responsible for saying who can talk. We don't want to be same thing in our committees. That's all up to the members up there. We are just the fly on the wall showing what's going on in the room. In this case, showing what's going on in the Zoom call, which is being run by a chairman or a committee person. So hopefully that answered your question. Okay.
Yeah, there's a number of interesting ways to do that. And the fun thing is once you start breaking that audio out, that's when you get into all sorts of fun with feedback.
Feedback, sync issues, out of lip sync.
So, you do one meeting where it all goes wrong, and then you realize we need to start doing some test meetings.
And we had a few of those when we started doing it. So I'm sure you guys did too. So
the other thing also, you using the broadcast infrastructure keeps your quality up. So when you start using Zoom for everything, your lowest common denominator camera drags everybody down. We discovered that in some of our webinars that we were doing. We'd have one person with a really crappy webcam, and all of a sudden, everything just fell apart and turned fuzzy.
We were always trying to strike that balance, because at the end of the day, we are affiliated with, first thing is we want it to look good for the people we serve. No one wants to sit there and watch a government meeting on a wide shot of a fuzzy camera. Even though technically, yes, you're documenting it, but, we want to make it look good. We want it to look good for our distribution on the PBS and all that other things, or our PBS subcarriers and on our website, so we don't want to just put anything up there. We want to make it, that's kind of the old, not old, I'm still the broadcast engineer, that's my background. But it's adapting that new IT thing and meeting it with broadcast standards to make, you're going to have some drop. I mean, when you're integrating a Zoom call in, you're always limited by the speed of your connection. You always want to get the best connection you can get. But there's going to be times where the connection drops. I mean, there's going to be times where speeds go up and down, or you're at an offsite location and you're at an offsite location and they give you a great connection and then everyone jumps in on their cell phones on the Wi-Fi and it just goes down the drain. We've all been there. There's things like that. And it's just learn and adapt. And again, trying to keep the quality as high as you can for the product. So
definitely. Any other questions out there? Well, gentlemen, thanks for taking the time to talk with us today. And thanks everybody for wandering in down the hall. Just remember there is lunch on the second floor. Ooh, I get a little bit of applause. We did great. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you. Yep.
Thanks for watching Broadcast to Post. Please make sure to subscribe to the podcast to receive future episodes. Follow Key Code Media on LinkedIn, Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram to receive news on additional AV, broadcast, and post-production technology content. See you next time, folks.